SD Motorsports on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Love Radio Network.
This is the San Diego Motorsports Show on AM 1170, The Answer. If it's a car, motorcycle, boat, or anything else with an engine in San Diego, it's on the San Diego Motorsports Show. Now, here's your host, Dave Stahl.
All right, folks. Hey, welcome back. This is SD Motorsports brought to you by El Cajon Ford, where nobody, absolutely nobody, treats you better. 1595 East Main Street in El Cajon. Mention you heard right here on KCBQ for a definite discount. ElCajonFord.com, ElCajonFord.com, where nobody, absolutely nobody, treats you better. Mark Maynard in the house, hanging out, feet up on the desk. He's definitely chilling.
Spread out like a professional.
Ever since you moved to Hamul, I'm telling you. We have a very, very, very special guest on the line, a good friend of Mark Maynard's. I have not met him, I don't think. Would you like to introduce
Preston Lerner?
Yeah.
Preston is a skilled automotive writer. He's written, we'll find out exactly how many, but his coffee table books, it's the writing that goes, that just makes this story sing with this. And that's why I enjoy any book Preston writes. Right. So that's...
Well, you know, I read books as much as I can possibly get. And when I picked his up, you're right. It's such an easy read. I mean...
And you get the history, you get the good historic photographs in that book, Ford GT.
Now that Preston's head is so big, he'll probably never get out of the room that he's in. Preston, how are you doing today, sir?
Hi, Dave. How are you? Mark, how are you?
Great.
Excellent. Got to tell you, you know, it's interesting in the foreword of your book, you know, you talk about the fact that a lot of people have written about, you know, Carroll Shelby, Enzo Ferrari, the GT40s, yada, yada, yada. And I've read just about all of them, but this is another compliment, so make sure your head will fit. This book has been, now, I got to tell you, I haven't read the last chapter, but I already know what the end is, I didn't want to ask you any questions about it, because I want people to buy the book and find out what the true ending is.
Ask him the questions now so we can hear. That's cool.
Well, it was just the acknowledgement. To me, this book was done in such a way, in all honesty, it should be 700 pages. But he was able to condense it to, what, 2-something, 220?
That's the hard part.
Yeah. Thanks very much. It's really... those are really great compliments, and I appreciate you having me on here. But I have to confess, I mean, as I mentioned in the beginning, in the foreword, I mean, you know, a lot has been written on the subject, so I'm really standing on the shoulders of a lot of guys who came before me and wrote a lot of great material. It sort of made my job a lot easier. And I was, you know, sort of synthesizing a lot of material. I mean, I got some new material as well and interviewed. There are not a lot of guys around.
Right, that's the problem.
Later. But, yeah. But I think I was able to synthesize a lot of material and sort of place it in perspective, especially stuff that had been written back in the day. You know, 50 years later, we look at things a little bit differently and have a different perspective on what happened. So I was really glad I had the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, and one of the things I was not aware of, I didn't know there was a GT40 without a roof.
Right. Yeah, well, there weren't many of them. They weren't too successful.
Well, no, of course not. And then the two-speed automatic transmission, what they call it, the power shifter.
Power shift, and there was another three-speed semi-automatic as well, which also didn't work well enough, unfortunately. So, right. Four-speed was good enough, but those top loader four-speeds were pretty effective.
I mean, I know they dinked around with a lot of the Kalatis and all that, you know, but with as much abuse, you know, every time I think about that, first thing I think of is Carroll Shelby, because I bet he was a gorilla on transmissions.
I'm sure you're right.
I can't help myself.
I can think back in those days to make a car last 24 hours, especially, you know, and he did it. You know, they had to be pretty careful, I think, on everything. So.
Yeah, without a shadow of doubt. And it's such a, you know, it's such a story. I'm surprised they haven't made a movie of this.
Well, supposedly, you know, A.J. Bame, who wrote the book Go Like Hell, came out a couple of years ago, really well done. It's sort of more of the personal story, sort of dramatizes. But supposedly that was optioned by, I believe, Brad Pitt. And, you know, they got some people there. There have been some scripts written, and they're still trying to get it made. But, yeah, it seems like a made-for-TV or a made-for-movies kind of story, doesn't it?
Well, and it's interesting, too, like who would play Dan Gurney? Who would play Phil Hill? Who would play, what's his face? I can't think. I mean, all these different people that I've read about and I've seen and watched and been around. It'd be interesting. I mean, I would watch it. You know, I think, and it could possibly be the, you know, probably what, the second best automotive movie ever, racing movie ever done outside of Grand Prix.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what was the best one? Yeah, that's my, that'd be tops of my list as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you and me both. And I think it needs to be done because it really tells a story, you know, about Ford Motor Company that a lot of people have no idea. And I think, and I was just telling Mark before we come on air, and that was when they gave him that little note that said, yeah, win. And who did he give that to? What was his face?
Leo Beebe.
Yeah, Leo Beebe. And Leo Beebe kept that in his wallet until the day he died.
Pressure's on.
Can you imagine though, Leo Beebe? So the guy is, just cut me off here when I say too much here. But so he's working, I think, head of marketing or something over in Europe.
Right.
And he gets hired to run the Ford racing program. And he's never been to a race before. And he's told, so all you have to do is go out and win Indy 500, win Le Mans, win the Daytona 500.
He's a kid. You know?
Yeah, right. What should I do next?
Yeah. And what did he start off every one of his meetings with? Well, you know, I don't know anything about motorsports, or I don't know anything about racing. And he didn't. But
I think actually the first races he went to was the Indy in 64, where Dave McDonald and
right.
Davies what's his name, Eddie Sachs were killed. And then he goes to... Mm-hmm. He goes down to, was it the Southern 500 where Fireball Roberts is killed, and he's thinking, "Boy, this is a great business that they got me involved in."
Blood sport.
Well, and it was back in those days. I mean, safety wasn't an issue. I mean, it's, you know, it kind of was what it was. But the book really gets you in what it takes to put a race car together. You know, it's, you can't go down to the parts house and pick up everything you need. I mean, it would be nice, but Hallman and Moody probably was the closest entity to that. I mean, they were trying to make race proven, you know, components.
Turnkey.
Yeah, well, so that you could put a suspension part on or an exhaust or whatever, and hopefully it would last because they tested it. And right. The Hallman and Moody, that was a interesting group. You got a pretty much an engineer on one end and a salesman on the other.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I think what's really, one of the things I found really interesting, I mean, I'm like you guys, you know, I was a racing fan from when I was growing up. I mean, this happened just before kind of I first started following racing, so I didn't live through it. But one of the things I found really interesting is doing the research and you know, finding out more of the backstory is how this kind of established the model for the way teams go racing to this day. I mean, it's sort of in-house engineering, but, you know, outsourcing actual race operations to professional teams. You know, back until then, I mean, Ferrari did everything in-house, and, you know, Jaguar and Aston Martin, all those, they would just do everything in-house. So the Ford method and, you know, with all the testing, I mean, just incredible amounts of testing and notes would go back and forth because it was this giant bureaucracy. It was really fascinating to look at just some of the debriefs, which are now kind of commonplace, but I think back then, you know, right. It was pretty unusual, and it was a different way to go racing, and obviously it was pretty effective.
Yeah, and the minute they were going to do something, got to have a committee. We need a committee. And Henry Ford, or the Ford family, it was like, okay, we're going to have a committee, and all the top dogs are going to be on this committee, and you got, because let's face it, you know, we don't want to give too much of the story away, but, you know, they didn't do very well the first 2 years.
Right, yeah. And I don't know if that was an organizational issue. I mean, I just think, you know, racing's hard, you know, as we know. It's like you just don't go, you just don't build a car, go racing, and start winning races, you know, it's especially endurance races. So, but I think Ford didn't understand that, and they were clearly unhappy with the Brits, and that's one of the reasons why. That's the reason why Shelby got the program, really,
without a shadow of a doubt. Now, let me ask you this, because as I'm reading this, because okay, Shelby's having nothing but problem with brake pads; they're having problems with rotors cracking. But none of the other competition was that I'm aware of were having the problems that Shelby were having. I mean, why wouldn't? I'm surprised they didn't look out. Maybe because they didn't want to run, you know, Girling brakes or something from Europe. I don't know. But
they're reinventing the wheel.
Well, it just seemed like, you know, they kept beating their head against a wall with a product they couldn't fix. I mean, they did everything they could, from self-releasing brake pads so that they could at least change the pad. And they were going through pads and rotors like candy. But didn't you seem that a little strange that I've never heard Ferrari have that kind of a problem, or Jaguar or Aston.
Well, it's true. Well, you know, I think brakes were more of an issue back then than they are now. I mean, now we don't even think about them, you know, whether it's a street car or a race car. I mean, you just pound them and they last forever. But also, I think it's really important to remember two things. I mean, the Ford was insanely heavy. I mean, compared to the anything else that was out there. And it was running faster. So there were just, and, you know, Le Mans was particularly hard on brakes because you had that ridiculous brake zone at the end of the Mulsanne. And, you know, so you run 3.4 miles at 210 miles an hour, and the brakes, you know, they're like 12 degrees, you know, by the time they get to the brake zone. And
right.
And all of a sudden, they're pounding on the brakes to get down to 30 miles an hour, bleed off 180 miles an hour. And yeah. So I think it was, I think the problem was just the car was too heavy, and the brake pad technology in particular, well, actually in the rotors as well, weren't
right.
good. I mean, you know, in 67, they actually ran ducting from the radiator so that warm air from the radiator would duct to the brakes.
Wow.
So that they would keep the brake temperatures up, you know, going down into the brake zone for
sure.
The Mulsanne corner. And, you know, and the famous story that Gurney tells is also about how he would brake really, really, really early. I mean, just so he wouldn't shock the rotors, you know, with and that really worked pretty effectively. So smart guy, Dan Gurney.
Well, it's funny you even, and by the way, I voted for him for president. I did. I still got my sticker. I still got my. I'm old, but the thing what it reminded me of is I went to Buttonwillow and drove the new Mustang 350 GT, and one of the professional drivers, you know, took me out after I drove. Well, I drove, and you know, I'm going into the turns. Every time he come up the turn, he would jump on those brakes like as if there was a $100 bill that he was going to pick up.
Right.
And I'm thinking to myself, why? Why is he hammering this thing as hard as he's? Because I rode with Hurley Haywood at Willow, and he was butter smooth. There was none of this slamming on the brakes and wrenching the car. So I don't know. And maybe it could just be like you say, Gurney understood it, and he still was fast, but he didn't abuse his equipment. I think he was one that was very good on his equipment, if I'm not mistaken.
He was, but I think he had a terrible record at Le Mans. I mean, you know, Le Mans, especially back then. I mean, you know. A quarter of the cars would finish the race, so it's not like today where
right.
they run flat out from the flag and, you know, they're running at the end of the race. But I think his car broke for whatever reason many, many times, and so he was hell-bent in 67, the chapter you haven't read yet, but he was hell-bent to survive to the end. And but I'm curious, Dave, you remember my impression, of course, and again, I didn't live through it, but just from seeing all the coverage after the fact. I mean, this was a really big deal back in the day, right?
Oh, man. Well, I graduated in 1964.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, I gave up my prom to watch the Monte Carlo Grand Prix. I mean, I like ate, slept, and drank. I used to go to Riverside. I mean, I'll tell you how crazy I am. I joined the Army in 1966 to go to Germany to buy a Lotus Super 7, build it in the auto shop, and take the British driving schools so I could be a race car driver like Dan Gurney, Jim Clark, Phil Hill, and the gang. And they sent me to Korea and put me in a tank. So things
which
didn't,
he turned into a hot rod.
That's right. I had a 62-mile-an-hour M88 tank that would only go 31 miles an hour, and I have the police record and pictures and radar and all that stuff. But, no. But, you know, back then, and your book brought it back so clearly, I'm not try to blow smoke, but it really brought back things that I had remembered that I had either read in Road and Track or the magazines that, you know, I used to get, you know, monthly and just couldn't wait to see what was going on. TV was a little new back in those days, but, you know, they didn't cover a lot of it. But just it's just amazing when you listen to what these guys had to do and what they had to go through, you know, to get to the end result. And then the politics. Enzo Ferrari, what a butthead.
Yeah. Well, successful, though.
Well, yeah, very successful. But, you know, and if a lot of people don't realize, if they were ever to go to his where he built the cars, they would expect this great big Roger Penske type shop. And it was the farthest thing from it.
Right. Yeah.
It's just absolutely amazing.
Preston, some of the in doing your research.
Oh, wow.
I don't know where you got that, but I'm sure as you were going, I would suppose you had access to Ford archives or racing archives. You know, how about some of the papers that you uncovered and went, oh, my God, listen to this.
The photos alone. The photo. One photo, and I wish I was good. I will never write in your book. I'll just let you know right now because that's sacrilege. But there was one, and I can't remember who was jumping out of the car, but he was wearing penny loafers.
Right. I think it was Maston Gregory.
Exactly. That was one of my favorites, too. Maston Gregory. He was getting out of the car. He had penny loafers on. I mean, it's just and these cars were gorillas. I mean, especially the big ones. You know, and you know, oh my Lord, it's just, you know, and then everything was trial and error. Even though they had wind tunnels, it was still trial and error. I mean, when they found out the GT40, the nose would sort of come up in the air and they would break. They must have had cases of aluminum. And they were constantly making wickers and ducktails. And I didn't know any of that either.
Canards.
You know? Pardon?
Canards.
Oh, yes. Canards. It's right up
canards.
There.
Yeah. But yeah, that's hysterical. I love the photo. Well, the photos are they're almost all from Dave Friedman. And Dave, as you guys, I'm sure, know.
Yeah.
But Dave, you know, he was hired by Shelby at Shelby American to be the in-house photographer, which shows you what a marketing genius Shelby was.
Oh, God, yeah.
I think to document that stuff. And then he was hired by Ford Motor Company. So Dave had access to all the, you know, whether he shot it himself or whether it was Ford archival stuff. I mean, he had all the primo material you want. And so that was great, and it was especially great for me because I didn't have to do any of that. So he provided it all. But Ford, amazingly, has, like, nothing in their archives, or very, very little in their archives. They have a bunch of they did it well after the fact, Q&As, and they did transcripts with, you know, like Don Fry and Ford and a bunch of those guys. But, I mean, the actual records were going to be thrown out. And a guy named Mike Teske, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, and I'd never heard of him, actually, until starting this project. And he managed to, by hook or crook, he got a hold of basically all the internal memos and whatnot that were that Ford had back in Dearborn from the program. And he's got them in, I don't know how many, like 50 four-drawer file cabinets in his home. And so I was able to go by there, and I could have spent, you know, 2 weeks there. It was just like 3 days. But so these are all the reports. Like every time they would test at Riverside or Willow or, you know, wherever they went, you know, Shelby would write a report. The Shelby American, and Holman and Moody would write a report, and it would go back, and then the Ford engineers would write a report, and all this stuff was all there. It's like, and it's great. It was just, you just see with all the things that they worked through, you know, before they would go racing. It was fascinating to sort of see that from behind the scenes.
And these memos were not nice. Exhaust will not last 12 to 24 hours. Brakes will not last 12 to 24 hours. Suspension will not last 12 to 24 hours. Chassis will not last. I mean, it couldn't have been a little nicer. I mean, I was cracking up.
Yeah, but that was really interesting to see, and just to sort of get a little insight into how they did the program. Because frankly, you know, when you look at the race record, they didn't really race very much. I mean, the cars, so the GT40s, you know, they built them as customer cars. They built 130 plus cars. There's kind of a dispute over how many exactly were built, but I mean, the Ford Motor Company race teams only ran like two dozen races, even less than that, I think, total. Because, you know, after 66, after winning Le Mans, they tested for the rest of the year. You know, in 67, after winning Le Mans, they just shut down the program. So for them, testing was as important, if not more important, than actual going racing, which is very much different than the way things would be done today.
Wow. What documents or stories did you uncover that were new to you
that
or
blew
something
you away.
That, yeah, that blew you away? That's the fun stuff as a researcher. You go, oh, my.
Or better yet, stuff you found you didn't put in the book.
Well, I was surprised. I was happy to find some financial numbers that the, you know, because that's always been a point of dispute. And I don't think the ones I had were necessarily accurate because I don't think they itemized everything. You know, it's a lot of stuff just, you know, went under like foundry and engine and foundry budget. You know,
Right.
But so, you know, to see the actual hard numbers where they were talking about this is, and then there were the numbers actually. One of the things I really got a kick out of was before the race in 67, they were already looking at 68.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were already planning to build this Calliope engine, which was this Revalve overhead cam V8, which never got built. Or actually it was built, I think, and tested, but it was never, I don't think it ever went into a race car.
Mm-hmm.
So to see like that they had already started thinking ahead and they'd already put together a budget for 68 and, you know, that's when the whole thing got, you know, basically they pulled the plug on the whole program. So, you know, I was fascinated to see that. There were some documents about the Ken Miles getting killed at Riverside, which were, you know, that was one of the real mysteries and it still is a mystery. I mean, they never decided what happened.
Right.
To this day, nobody really knows what did happen. And, I, you know, there were at least four or five theories that I heard. And people who believe, but who knows at this point?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, and that's a sad fact. But there's, you know, like you said, that's going to be one of those mysteries that you'll never ever, you know. And my whole thing, and granted, and again, it was back to the GT40 without the roof. That and the fact that instead of archiving one of these, they chopped it up, threw it away.
Right. Yeah.
Just an old race car.
Well, that's what old race cars were about. They were just, you know, most of the time, you know, depending on the level of the racer, most chance he'd take all the parts and pieces off of it and go put it on another one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, I just did a story on the GT40P 1046. Is that was the chassis that won in 1 in 66?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so that was the black one with the silver stripes, so that Chris Amon and Bruce McLaren were driving. And so, you know, they come back to the States and they paint a bunch of cars black and silver and they send them all over the country to these shows. And the actual race winner goes on and races again, like at Daytona, and they use it for testing. And then they just lose sight of it completely and sold the thing.
Mm.
You know, so they didn't even keep the car. And the theory is that they had so many of these black and silver things floating around that nobody even knew what the real, you know, 66 race winner was.
Oh,
you know?
My God.
And it just disappeared from their collection. They of course, kept the 67 car, which was smart. But it's kind of hard to believe that the 67 winner disappeared from their collection, and
it's now been
restored, and it'll be at Le Mans later this month. So
you going to Le Mans?
I am, actually. I'm really looking forward to it. Are you guys going to be going?
No, we're so far down the list. We would even go over.
Radio broadcast from Le Mans would be good.
Hey, we would even go. I'd drag my radio gear in a heartbeat. Are you kidding, dude? That's on my bucket list. I mean, but it's not as long as we got guys like you, then we don't, you know, we can live through you vicariously.
Let's explain again. The book we're talking about is Ford GT by Preston Lerner. It's a Motor Books publication, correct?
Well, actually, it's now called Quarto Publishing.
I don't know why they
used to be Motor Books.
Yeah, but by the way, folks, I don't know if this will hurt you or not, but if you go to their website and buy his book, and when you leave, put STALL11 as the promo code, and they'll give you 25% off.
Hey, excellent. I may do that myself.
Well, see, there you go. And all you got to do is, and Nicole, she'll take care of you and hook you up. But so I know you're just like the car manufacturers. What's your next project?
Exactly.
You know, I have an idea in mind, but I don't have a publisher right now, so I'm hoping to do something on kind of the 60s and 70s, which I find to be a really fascinating era of when kind of big money came in and manufacturers came in. And
racing in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah,
I'm sorry, racing in the 60s and 70s, correct. So, because that was the era, you know, when real money came in and speeds, aerodynamics were just kind of started to become more sophisticated and it also became very dangerous, that much more dangerous even than it was. I mean, you know, there were two drivers killed in Ford GTs, which is too many, obviously, but by the standards of the time, it was a really safe car, had a gigantic NASCAR-style roll cage in it in 67, and so several drivers I talked to said that if they were going to crash in a car, they wanted it to be in a GT40.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, a Formula One car or a Porsche, God forbid.
Yeah, God forbid is right. No, I tell you, so it's...
How many books have you written?
Yeah, how many have you written?
I think I believe that was my fifth. So a couple of other racing books and actually one novel had nothing to do with racing, but the first racing book I did was on the Scarab, which was the All-American race car that was built up here. I know you guys down in San Diego, but this was built up in Venice in LA.
Yeah.
So, and it's, you know, first Formula One, American Formula One car. And that was a really cool project. So
neat.
Excellent. All right. Hey, man, I really want to thank you for taking time out of your Sunday to call in and talk about your book because, man, I tell you, it's just amazing book. I mean, you really, really, really did a great job.
Well,
Mark.
Preston's a wordsmith and a craft.
Yes, he is.
You know, writing is a craft.
Yeah, I can't do it. Though. I tried. Trust me.
Thank you, really. And, Mark, special thanks to you, and I appreciate all the nice words.
Well, hey, the next book you got coming out, let us know. We'll read it, and then we'll get you back on. Because if nothing else, we'd love to have you on just talking about vintage racing because, you know, the generations today, unless they go buy your book or books like it, you know what I mean? No one's ever going to know. And I think it's important that, you know, guys like you with talent keep the younger generations informed because it's history. I don't care if it's the history of the States or the history of the car, but history of motorsports because of all of us that drive cars today, would be in a lot worse shape if we didn't have motorsports in the beginning.
I agree with you. And 50 years, it's they're starting to, those guys are starting to die off now. So
yeah. Yeah, no kidding. All right, bud, thanks a lot, and we'll be talking to you down the road, and I'll send you a copy of the show.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
All right, you take care, buddy.
Bye now.
Bye.
All right. Hey, we're going to have to go and take a small break, but we've got Chris Holt on the line. He's going to chat with us about Paris Auto Speedway right here on ST Motorsports with Dave Stahl and Mark Maynard. We'll be right back. We are The Answer.
AM 1170, The Answer.
Welcome back. You're listening to SD Motorsports. Dave Stahl, Mark Maynard right here on KCBQ AM 1170. This segment's brought to you by Paris Auto Speedway, 18700 Lake Paris Road in Paris, California. They got racing. Check their schedule at parisautospeedway.com. Right now we have Chris Holt on the line. He's going to talk to us about a race coming up next week. Chris, how you doing,
Hello,
buddy?
Dave. Excellent.
So how's
Calling
life?
Calling in talk to you about what's coming up.
Yeah, what you got?
Well, this Saturday coming up, we have the USAC CRA Sprint Cars along with the Young Guns and the Senior Sprints, and it's called Moose Night. This is where one of the competitors here has gathered up all their friends and family and everything. They're going to have a big party there in the grandstand, so we name this Moose Night.
Moose Night, that's pretty clever. Yeah. Is this first year you guys are doing that?
No, they've been doing it for quite a bit. It's actually Tom and Lori Searchers. They go way back to, 30 years ago with racing. They've been around for a long time. And their driver, Jake Swanson, right now, has been doing real good this year. He's just coming off a third-place finish last time out. So
oh, cool.
They're real happy.
Yeah. Well, and, people do that. Those kind of folks, how do we ever deal without them? they're not in it for the money. They're in it for the sport.
Definitely. I kid tell people I can remember when they were running race cars on credit cards, but it's just about that way for them.
Well, it's funny you say that because I was at a destruction derby for the firefighters here in town, and they were in between races, and how they'll tear up their cars, and some people were walking, and one guy was saying, he says, "I don't know why they do this." I said, "Hey, by the way, they're taking a lower control MR for car out in the parking lot," and he, "What?" I said, "That's old school." And even the fire guys are starting to laugh because back in the day, that's what we did.
Yeah.
Cannibalize.
Yep.
Yeah, I can remember on stock car nights, someone going out and getting an engine out of their grandma's car.
You're not telling any stories now, are you?
No, true story.
But we won't say who it was.
I don't even remember.
I'm sure you don't. So so next week, so that's going to be a good show. Where is that in the championship standings? Is it in the middle of the season? How are we doing?
Yeah, we're about mid-season now. We got the June 11th coming up here, then the 4th of July show. That's actually on July the 2nd.
Yeah.
And then they're back again at the end of the month. So it goes right on through August 27th is the big Hall of Fame night. That's when everybody shows up from the past.
Oh, man.
They pack the place with all the past champions. It goes on through to the Oval Nationals.
Yeah. And the nice thing about the 27th of August is that a lot of vintage race cars are up there as well. So if you want to see what it was like screaming around these tracks and cars from the days gone by, and the drivers are there. A lot of the drivers are still there. They can tell you the stories. I think that's probably one of the really cool parts about this, about that event on the 4th of July.
Yeah, well, 4th of July.
That's not the 4th of July, but
August 27th. That's, like I said, the Hall of Fame night. And that's a big night for the Western Racing Association. That's called the Moving Museum. So they'll all bring out their cars, and a lot of them will just have them out in the parking lot. But they'll be out on the racetrack, too, the old offies. It's a real fun night. And the past champions, they get right in with the fans. They'll sign autographs. They'll get the sports bars. It's a fun night.
Put your kids in one of their race cars if you want to get your son or daughter or get a picture.
Absolutely.
I have a photo of me in a midget from 1952 in Oakland, California, because they used to race indoor.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sitting in that car. I found that picture just the other day, and I've got a goofy helmet on. It doesn't fit, and I look like I just ate the cat.
How old were you?
I was probably four or five.
4 years old?
I'll bring it and show it to you. Man, I tell you what, my eyeballs were so big.
Big old grin.
it ruined me. I mean, it ruined me. I wanted to race my whole life. But, you know, that's the neat thing about taking kids to Paris Auto Speedway and taking them into the pits and introducing them to the drivers. And drivers get it. They'll throw kids in their cars, take pictures all day long. That's the bomb.
We actually have a new program where they'll go out and they'll pick out one kid out of the grandstands, and he gets a special autographed trophy by the winner. Well, we did this last 2 weeks ago, and the guy, it was his first ever race. It was about a 10-year-old kid.
Oh, my God.
Ear-to-ear grin. It was just kind of a storybook ending.
Yeah, so it's your fault now. Because that kid is going to be hounding his mom and dad, boy, I'm telling you. Because it did. I mean, it's oh, my gosh, that is. Well, you know, that's Don Kazarian. I mean, he is always looking ways to give back to the fans. And I think that's a sweet idea, really.
Well, so this race coming up, this is a exciting race in a whole lot of ways. We got a new young gun deal going. You know, it's about the third or fourth year now. And there's two girls that are first and second, and they are duking it out. They're catfighting. They're banging wheels.
Really?
And they're racing hard.
Who are they?
Well, there's Hannah Mayhew. She's from Acton, California, up high. And then a local, Courtney Crone. She's just turned 15 years old. And she's racing midgets. She finished seventh place last night with the USAC midgets. And they're going fast.
Oh,
they're going real fast. And they're racing hard. And the fans are loving this deal, the young gun deal. And then the senior sprints, that these are guys that you would think should be retired. They're turning in times that they can compete with the 410s. These guys are racing really good. And then we got our, you know, regular USAC CRA deal that's really turning into a great deal, because right now there are so many guys that could win a main event. It's not like the old days, you know, where you had maybe three or four that could win. There's like 10 guys that could win on any night. So it's going to be a good night.
That's easy on the old guy routine. Okay. I mean, come on. I mean, Courtney's the one on your right.
I just showed
Mark a picture, because we've had Courtney on radio before.
Uh-huh.
Not only is she a great driver, but she is a great personality as well.
And she wants to win.
Oh, dude, I would never tell her that she couldn't win.
She does not want to run.
And she knows who. I was just showing
getting
a picture.
Her way.
I was just showing a picture to Mark, and she's standing with Lynn St. James, which is one of her mentors.
Thrill. Yeah.
Well, Lynn St. James does such a lot for the young ladies that are trying to get into motorsports. I mean, she really is a great asset. I mean, I think, doesn't she have her own little program as well?
Yeah, she does have a program, and so there's a Kara Hendrick Foundation.
Right.
They have another program for the young ladies. So we actually have three ladies in the Young Gun deal this year. There's also Melissa Perkins.
Right.
She's out of Newport Beach. So the girls are getting it done.
Well, there's no reason why they can't. I mean, really, when you come right down to it, I mean, they're doing it in drag racing. They're doing it. I mean, why couldn't they? And the dirt, you know as well as I do, once you get the car up and running and going and moving, you know, it's about like ballet. You know, now it's just a matter of finesse. And I think girls have got great finesse. Guys got testosterone.
Yeah.
These girls swear that there's nothing a guy can do that they can't.
Oh, yeah.
And they're out there proving it right now.
Yeah. And I think that's so good for the younger generations coming up. You know, there was a time when you couldn't even let a woman come in the pits.
Yeah.
Bad luck.
And, you know, talk about the younger generation. We have a lot of new drivers in the USAC CRA deal. If you look at who's running up front, we have like the 2009 rookie, 2010 rookie. These guys in the last 5 years, they're pushing these other guys out because they're racing hard. And, you know, the Tony Jones, Ricky Gaunce, all these guys, I don't think they can keep up with them.
No.
They're retiring.
And, you know, you can almost say that in all the motorsports. Look at NASCAR. Look at the young kids coming up that are just, you know, the Kyle Larsons of the world that have no problem pushing Kyle Busch into the fence if he has to get
19 years old.
Well, yeah, they don't know any fear. No, and it's great to see that evolution. But I'm really thrilled to see girls getting more into sprint car racing. I really am.
You know, you mentioned that Kyle and these guys pushing the big boys around in NASCAR. They learn that on these little dirt tracks in Paris and in California and stuff. That's where most of these guys that are running up front came from.
Well, haven't you noticed? I would say the top 5% of pretty much NASCAR, Infinity, were all dirt trackers.
Yep.
Because if you don't have that dirt experience under your belt, then you're going to miss.
Yeah.
Tony
Stewart.
I watch
a NASCAR race now, and I'll sit there and count how many guys in this race raced at Paris.
Mm-hmm.
10, 12.
Yeah. Yeah. No. People don't realize how important Paris Auto Speedway is to the racing community and Southern California in general. Because let's face it, it's Paris and Barona, and that's it. And I don't know if you were old enough or remember Highway 117.
Speedway 117.
They're having a reunion. I don't know if you heard about it.
Uh-uh.
And if you want to get involved, I didn't bring it with me, but I'll tell Scott to get you the information, because if you've been to that track, I'm sure you'll want to come down for the reunion.
Yeah, that was a fast racetrack, long straightaways.
Oh,
boy, did they get going.
Yeah, I got a great story for that one, too. So I worked at a car dealership down there, and they needed a convertible for the Trophy Queen. So they said, hey, Dave, you want to do it? I said, sure. So I had a 81 Toyota Celica convertible. I can get on the track, and all the race cars are behind me.
Oh, no.
It's terrible.
Can't be good.
I couldn't stand it. I hit that first turn, man. I slid that car sideways, and I'm rooster tailing it, and the girl's down on the floor screaming her head off.
Oh, God.
Oh, no, it was rear wheel drive. Oh, no. Oh, it was ugly, so they wouldn't let me do it anymore. Well, I told them I was a race car driver, and this is not something I wanted to do. Put me in a race car, and I'll be happy. But, yeah, it was kind of ugly, but...
Yeah,
but I'm glad they're having a reunion. I'm glad. I'm really thrilled that that's going to be. So I'm sure you'll probably want to find out more about that when the time gets closer.
Yeah, hopefully it's not on a race day. Hey, we got Mike Spencer. You know, the 5-time champion. He's in a brand new ride. This is a top of the line ride.
Yeah,
Gadsden Engineering has put together a great piece for him. And then we got Brody Roa, who was fast time again. He's the 2012 Most Improved Driver. He's running great. He was running second place right up until the last lap. We got Rookie of the Year 2010, Jace Vanderveer, that came from 15th to 7th last week, 2 weeks ago. A lot of things going on that people would like to come out here to Paris this Saturday and watch this race.
It's only an hour and a half out of San Diego, folks. It's a piece of cake, trust me. And they're done by about, what, 10-ish?
We try to get done by 10. You know, sometimes they go over. You never know. You know, there could be a crash. There usually is. And the medical crew, they're really good, but they do slow down to take precautions. Yeah. If they have to take someone out of the car, they slow down. But that can add 10 minutes to a race sometimes. And, you know, you get to them, and now you're about 20 minutes over. So it can get into 10:30.
Well, you don't see too many people get upset when they know there's been an accident and everybody's waiting patiently to see what they can do to make sure everybody's good to go. So it works out great. Hey, man, thank you very much. I appreciate you calling in, and I'm sure I'm going to try to get up next Saturday. I'm going to just try. That's all I can do, but because I have to get up real early to do TV on Sunday, so that's a killer for us old guys. But I'll definitely try to get up there. ParisAutoSpeedway.com, folks. You need to check it out. Be there or be square. Chris, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you down the road.
Okay, Dave.
All right, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a small break. When we come back, more right here on KCBQ AM 1170. We are the answer.
AM 1170. The answer.
All right, folks. Hey, welcome back. You're listening to SD Motorsports right here on KCQ AM 1170. The segment brought to you by Certified Car Care. Mention you heard this on the radio right here on KCBQ, and you'll get a free dyno pull with your hot rod free of charge. And I just want to hopefully everybody goes out and votes. I wrote myself in. I will be president. You think?
You're gonna
put your name
in the primary. Everybody's like, oh, let's see
vote
how
for
it
Dirt Dude.
Out.
Let's vote for Dirt Dude.
Dirt
what do
Dude
you
think? For president.
Hey, this segment is brought to you by Certified Car Care. As I mentioned, Woodside Avenue, get a free dyno. All right, let's bring old Dirt Dude on the line. We'll get our boss here to push the button. How you doing, Hollywood?
Hey, pretty good. I know I get at least one vote if I vote for myself.
That's what I'm doing. Yeah. And who knows? I might get a car.
Yeah.
Anything for a car. So how you doing, bud?
Not much, dude. I guess you guys had fun over at the burn.
You're lucky. I'm still talking. Because I did it.
And that's a lot to stop
from
Dave from
10
talking.
Until 7.
I saw the pictures of it. I was like, oh, if I didn't have a race, I'd be there. That would be so fun.
Dude, it was
we had a race.
Awesome. Yeah. And how'd it go last night?
It was great. Actually, it was really great.
How'd our little girl do, Sandoval?
She finished. She had some problems with the car, still getting it dialed in.
Yeah.
I wanted to send a special congratulations to Todd Fleisler. He won at Paris. He's one of our drivers. Him and Rick Eichstead kind of share a car.
Cool.
And they won the factories at Paris last night. So that was cool for them. Go up there and do that. We had our street stocks. Dave Capella got his first main event win. Three races. Third race in the car. He just built this car. Third race, got a main event win in it.
Wow.
It was strong. That car was actually strong. I don't think anyone was going to catch him. Had a couple of cautions, you know, bottled them all back up, and he would just kind of just walk away from everybody. Mm. Robert Pierce is reeling him in the 22. I don't know if he had him there or not. Dwarf Cars, Austin Wiley got a main event win. And the special one of that race was 77. Phil Comfort built this new car. And he came out and he had problems in the heat race, broke the front end, had some ball joint, I think a tie rod and ball joint broken on it, started dead last in the heat, finished third. That car was moving.
Whoa.
He had anything for Austin Weiland, but he was moving up to the group in that new, brand new car. So Bud did a good job last night with Phil Comfort driving it. And in our super stocks, Heber still got a main event win, getting around the 225 Billy Baldwin, which had a strong run for the whole time, and I think his car just kind of fell off. I think he used up every bit of tire he had because that car was strong for the first eight laps and then fell off after that.
Mm.
In our modifieds, we stacked up a bunch of them. It was a good race, but they're trying to take four modifieds into turn three, and there's no way you're going to get that many cars four wide.
Yeah.
I think the track is like 60, 70 feet wide.
Yeah.
You know, four modifieds, a little bit more than that. So
somebody's against the wall.
They took a couple and watered them up, and
yeah.
It was. But we had Brian Schultz came out of Casa Grande, Arizona last night. Showed up late. I guess he was like, "Well, my day didn't go well at work," and so I just thought I'd come out.
Really?
Won the main event. Yeah, he was started from the back because he hadn't been there. No heat race, no nothing. Started from the back. Took a high line around the track, and it was just crazy. I've never seen anybody work the high line. They came in, and these guys couldn't get up fast enough to block him, and he passed everybody on the top, which is usually everyone stays at the bottom, but the top came in on that one, and he got a main event win. Once again, had a Casa Grande. That was a pretty good trailer ride for him up.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this. You think now everybody that watched him do that, you think next week or the next race, you're gonna start seeing people creep up there?
Depends. Last night was a different thing. We didn't actually cut the track during intermission. Our car count was 62, 63. Not a great car time. There was too much going on.
Yeah. You had the fair, you had Paris, you had you.
Yeah. And then we had like the heat. Oh my God, it was hot.
Oh, was it hot up there?
It was bad for the heat races, but as soon as the sun kind of dropped down over the hill,
cooled off.
Just feel it. The shade just kind of like when you got in the shade, it was perfect. You know, by the time we started our main events, it was just a really nice night. It was just, you know, comfortable.
Yeah.
And then, so the moisture, we put moisture back on the track. We didn't cut it because, like I said, we were worried about having a low car count running all the track back in. Is it worth it, you know, to cut that whole thing for what you're going to get out of it? So we just decided, okay, we'd water, and then it got kind of – it was dry slick after the heat races. It got that black groove, but if you water it, it's like a sponge. It'll soak up, and you water again and water it and water it and water it. It'll soak down in, and it'll bring back the track back to life. Yeah. It was what we kind of just did, and it still stayed pretty good. It was dry slick, but I don't think there's any way you're going to get away from dry slick when it's that hot out.
And dry slick's fun.
Yeah. I mean, you're never going to have that wet, tacky track, you know, every time, which is what ideally a dirt track is. You know, it should be, you're walking across it, it's taking your tennis shoes off because it's so tacky.
Right. Yeah, that's Paris Auto Speedway.
But a lot of groups, you know, like if you follow any of the big, fast cars, World Outlaws, they don't like tacky tracks. They like dry slick.
Yeah.
I mean, that thing is black grooved off, and they're putting rubber down to get their traction.
Yeah. Yeah.
To me, I mean, that's once you just race asphalt, if you're going to put rubber down on something hard.
Yeah.
I like to race stuff that's tacky. Really, you know, it's going to get a good bite out of it,
right.
what you're looking for.
Yeah.
But it worked out last night for that way.
Hey, are you doing anything for the 4th?
I don't know yet.
All of our kids are racing at Del Mar with monster trucks. So I think I'm going to try and maybe be there for that. I don't know. I don't really have a lot planned. Why? What do you got?
Well, if you need,
are you offering a date?
No, but if you need tickets, if you want tickets to the fair, just send me an email.
Okay.
And I can put them in.
Did you work with WJS? Who was out there?
WJS. Who's that?
WGAS is the one that is the sports promoter at the fair. They're the one that put on the event, maybe.
Oh, I didn't talk. I did talk to their audio people. Super guys. I had a great time working with them. I may have ran into them, but I was dealing with so many people. But let me tell you, you got to get out there next year because these cars are like nothing I've ever seen. They're putting more time and money into these demo cars. It's amazing. It is totally amazing.
That's a new sport, demo cross and demo derbies. Like you said, those guys can take those cars and actually get two or three demos out of them. It's not just you bring it to one and then that's it. No,
a couple of them that was the case, but as a general rule, it was, what they're doing now is they're putting forklift tires on the caddies, on the cars. You know, those big 10-ply, real heavy lugged, tractor tires. Yeah.
I'm surprised they haven't got the ones that are like solid foam filled, so they don't.
The only thing we noticed, because the dirt at the fairgrounds is so soft, that those big tractor tires, especially on a heavy car like a Cadillac or what have you, the minute he would stand on it, it would just blah, 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 and bury him into the dirt right down in the frame. So, and then one guy, he even had tractor tires on the front, and I went and told him, I said, take those off, put your stock tires back on the front. I don't want to blow a tire out. And sure enough, he buried himself. He buried all four wheels right in the center, almost over by the berm. But it was an amazing, amazing event. They raised a bucket load of money for the Burn Institute and that the Scars camp up at Escondido or Ramona. Man, it's just amazing.
Well, we're still pushing our event for August 13th. That's our Autism Awareness Night. And that's going to be hopefully our biggest night of the season. I still got you booked, or you got me booked for August 7th.
Okay, I do have you booked for KUSI.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
I talked with your director person and got it all situated out, and we're all set. So I'm going to have some special guests there. We'll get their information when we get there in the morning for their cause for the.
Yeah, just be there. It's a weekend, right?
Yeah, it's a Sunday.
Yeah, so it'll be there at 7, shoots about 7:40, 7:45, have you done and out by 8.
Yeah, I'm going to show up with a couple cars and then a couple kids from the foundation. It should be a lot of fun.
And you know what I would do? Just reach out to anybody at Barona. It doesn't have to be anybody would like to get some air time, for their cars and sponsors and stuff like that, because me, the more the merrier. Did you watch it this morning?
No, I didn't get a chance to.
Dan Plant.
I was recovering.
Well, we were doing Low Riders. Raza is having a car show next Saturday down at
J Street Marina.
So they bring this Olds or this Buick Regal, and it's it's sawn bags. So Dan says, "Hey, can you make it jump?" And the guy says, "Sure." So Dan says, "Can I get in?" I looked at the guy, and all I did is I reached down, and I took my finger and made a real hard circle as fast as I could. So Dan gets in it, and he just about broke his neck, and he almost jumped into another car parked next to him. And that's how radical it was. Yeah.
Well, I saw the one where you guys are launching the off-road truck
in
the parking lot. I'm like, how come Dan's not asking for a ride in that one?
I know. He wasn't there, thank God. It was Dave Davis, and that was another one of those, hey, I got an idea.
Because launch a car through the parking lot, from one gate into the other gate.
Duh. And then I had to come back Sunday because when he launched and landed the last time, he put about a 6-inch divot in the asphalt. Well, you would have thought we had a sinkhole. KUSI went crazy, so I went and bought splooge from Home Depot, fixed it, and if I had the money, I was going to buy 152 cones and block off the parking lot for a week. Yeah, driving crazy. Hey, buddy, we got to hit the road.
You caught that one right. You were just like, we're never going to do this again.
Yeah, but if he comes back, I'll do it again. Yeah. All right, bud. Hey, I will be chatting with you down the road. You have a great one, folks. This has been SD Motorsports with Dave Stahl and Mark Maynard. Whew, what a ride.
Great 3 hours.
Woo, fast as could be. All right, we're going to be out of here. We'll be back next week with more on KCBQ.
Going to the fair.
Yeehaw.
WSD Motorsports on AM 1170, The Answer, is sponsored by Love Radio Network.